Have you guys heard the news that scientists are developing a implant to cure cancer in just 60 days with a goal to slash death rates by 50%? I'm reading from the New York Post and it's kind of mind-blowing. Here's what it says. Curing cancer could soon be as easy as a few taps on your mobile, according to a team of scientists at Rice University, who have received $45 million in funding for a novel implant-based treatment system that could cut cancer death rates by 50%. It's wild. It's wild. So it seems like it's this implant that they put in your body, and it can detect cancer, and it can release sort of the sort of medicine, I suppose. I'm not a doctor here, in case you hadn't noticed. But it can do it. Sort of like it can adapt the way it does it according to how your body's responding. And if you have cancer, it can eradicate it in as little as 60 days. That's wild, wild stuff. Now, human trials don't begin for a while. Obviously, this is early developmental stages. I think I read that the human trials will start in about 5 years. Man, all I can say is I hope it works. I hope that this becomes a thing that, yeah, can. Anyways, my name is Pastor Marcus, and I want to welcome you back to the Story Church Podcast. Today, we're going to look at the top three must-know cultural shifts. Let's do it. So for those who are maybe unfamiliar with what the Story Church Podcast is all about, this is all about mission, but not just mission work in general, mission work specifically in post-modern context, post-modern, meta-modern, post-human, etc. Really, the phrase that I use most often is post-church because it kind of is a little bit more all-encompassing. And so in today's episode, I want to look at some of the emerging cultural shifts that as missionaries we need to be aware of and interacting with so that we can articulate the gospel meaningfully to the culture. And we're going to look at three of them. The first one is deconstruction and reconstruction. The second one is the grand existential project. And the third one is truth versus reality. And those might sound super nerdy. And maybe you're sitting there and you're like, dude, I'm not an academic. What does any of that mean? Don't worry about it. We're going to simplify it and keep it bite-sized. But before I get into it, I want to take a moment to invite you to open your phone. And I want you to go to thestorychurchproject.com. Go to thestorychurchproject.com because that is the website where it all happens, you guys. Everything that has to do with this missional project is located on thestorychurchproject.com. As soon as you get there, you'll see an image with a text that says Empowering Adventist Communities for Secular Outreach and a Start Here button. Here's the thing. If you tap that Start Here button, it'll take you to a link where you can download a free ebook titled How to Study the Bible with Postmoderns. Now, most of you listening to this podcast, I'm sure, have already downloaded it. But if you haven't, all you have to do is put your first name, last name, and email address, send it to me, and the ebook will be in your email, in your inbox, within a few minutes. I think you still have to go to your inbox and make sure it didn't end up in spam. And you have to kind of like do the whole, yes, I signed up for this mailing list thing. You have to do that first. But then once it's done, you got yourself a free ebook. And when the ebook email arrives, you'll also see a list of some of the new projects that are taking place. So if you've subscribed to this mailing list, say forever ago, you're not going to see that list. So how do you get that list that all the new subscribers get to? Easy. Just head to the toolbar at the top and tap the label media. Once you tap that label, boom, everything that people would see in that email, all the latest projects, the devotional app, the study guide, the blog, podcast, books, it's all there. Now, these resources have been especially created to empower missionaries across the globe. So I hope you take advantage of them and I hope you enjoy them. Let's get to the episode. So as I said, we're going to look at the top three ways in which culture is evolving, culture is shifting, things we need to be aware of as believers. But I need to say something very, very, very important before I even start. These three cultural shifts that I'm looking at, number one, apply mostly in the West. I don't know if they apply in Africa. I don't know if they apply in Eastern Europe. I don't know if they apply in Latin America. I have no clue. They apply mostly in the West. But even then, these are broad cultural shifts. The truth is that depending on what your immediate demographics are, the immediate community that you come from, these three shifts might be entirely pointless, right? And that's part of the challenge of modern secularism, is that it's so fragmented that there's just not one size fits all that describes everyone. So I'm just looking at three sort of overarching themes that tend to be general across the board. But, you know, depending on where you come from and your demographics and the specific anxieties that are faced in your community, these three might be entirely meaningless to people. So please keep that in mind. The missionary must always seek to understand the anxieties that surround him or her. Because if they don't, they're going to be applying templates to their context that don't actually matter in their context. So just keep that in mind. But with that aside, here are the three big shifts that I am noticing, generally speaking, in Western culture and among emerging generations. So number one, deconstruction to reconstruction. If you are familiar with postmodernism, which you should be, and if you're not, that's what the free ebook is for, then you know that the Western world has been steeped in postmodern thinking for quite a while. And one of the features of postmodernism is deconstruction. We're deconstructing the assumptions that we've used to build our societies, deconstructing the assumptions we bring to religion, to science, to politics, to sociology, etc. It's just a massive deconstruction project. Now, the challenge with postmodernism is that because it has such a focus on deconstruction, it can leave a person feeling pretty lost and disoriented after the deconstruction has taken place. Because like, hey, I've deconstructed my faith, I've deconstructed, you know, capitalism, I've deconstructed, you know, democracy, I've deconstructed, you know, all of these things, science, etc. And now that it's all deconstructed, now what do? I'm just kind of here with all this rubble around me and no real way to map my life through this. And so emerging generations are really moving away from postmodernism, moving away from this deconstruction project toward a more enthusiastic vision of the world. And so what this means is they're seeking not so much to deconstruct as they are seeking to reconstruct. Now, this reconstruction phase, it's what's termed metamodernism. And I gotta be honest with you guys, in case you've forgotten, postmodernism is actually kind of dead. It's old. It began dying a very, very long time ago. Around the 80s, academics were already saying, hey, the postmodern era is done. The metamodern era is what has come next. But these things never happen in neat little blocks. There's a lot of carryover. There's a lot of residue. And so there's a lot of postmodernism still in society, but we are seeing a shift toward metamodernism. And that shift is an enthusiastic shift, a shift of how do we rebuild? How do we create a future? How do we recapture a sense of hope in the hopelessness? And that's what the deconstruction to reconstruction shift is all about. It's moving away from the cynicism that postmodern deconstruction left us with and toward the enthusiasm of a metamodern reconstruction project. Let's rebuild. Let's recapture beauty. Let's create a hope in the future. I'm going to circle back around to that, but just wanted to explain this. So that's one of the biggest shifts that's taking place right now. The second one is that I'm seeing anyways, generally speaking, broadly speaking, is the grand existential project. And that's actually probably not the best way of defining it because it makes it sound like there's one unified existential project. There actually isn't. It's more of a mood than a unified project. And so the grand existential project has to be thought of as a mood that is manifesting itself in different ways. So for example, we have ecological justice that, you know, a lot of ecological justice movements that are taking place right now. You know, we need to save the planet. We need to, you know, stand in traffic and, you know, block people from, you guys have seen it in the news, right? We need to stop all those people going to Burning Man, you know, block the road, you know, ecological protest. And of course, we also have multiplanetary migration with people like Elon Musk who are looking at, you know, how can we actually live on different planets? So he's looking at at Mars. Others are looking at building some bases on the moon. That's an active conversation taking place right now. Jeff Bezos wants to build a floating city in space. They've even talked about having hotels in space pretty soon, just in the next decade. So what is the point of all of this? And of course, you can't mention these things without mentioning artificial intelligence as well. Artificial intelligence is set to alter the course of the human story significantly. It's going to be, once it's in full swing, it's going to be a gargantuan shift. And we'll revisit that a little bit more later. But why do I call these the grand existential project, though? Again, it's a mood, not necessarily a project where everyone's working together, because, you know, people in ecological justice movements may not necessarily care about multiplanetary migration or AI and vice versa. But the mood essentially is, humanity is facing an existential threat. We're going to go extinct, right? We're going to go extinct. The Earth is dying. We're not caring for it. We're not protecting it. We are exploiting it. And so Elon Musk, for example, says we need to build a city on Mars, because if life becomes unsustainable on Earth and we all live on Earth, then that wipes out the entire species. But if we have people living multiplanetarily, then even if something catastrophic happens on Earth, the species can continue to exist and survive, because we live in other worlds as well. And so, again, this isn't merely a billionaire with nerdy ideas. This is a very existential project. There's this sense in which we as a species, we're going to go extinct if we don't do something, right? And artificial intelligence is a big part of that. Even though there's a lot of fear around artificial intelligence pretty much being the thing that destroys the human species, the energy that's being put toward it is also because artificial intelligence may be the thing that saves the human species. It may enable us to come up with solutions that we wouldn't otherwise have been able to think of. And we need this super intelligent artificial sort of consciousness to really help us to find a way to save our world, to save our species. And so these are existential projects. And that's number two. That's a big, big shift. And we're going to see that coming at us at 1,000 miles an hour. It's coming, and it's coming quickly, because a lot of these movements and a lot of these projects, the technological advances are exponential. Will they end up looking the way people in the news today say they're going to look like? You know, are we actually going to end up with a city on Mars? Are we actually going to have a floating city in space? I don't know. That's not really the point, though. And I want to challenge you guys as missionaries not to get too caught up with the, oh, that's never going to happen, it's pointless, it's dumb, let's move on. Because whether it happens or not is not the issue. The issue as missionaries that we have to contend with is that there are anxieties that drive these projects. And how does the gospel speak to those anxieties? Regardless of whether the projects ever become true or not, how does the gospel speak to the anxieties that are driving it? So how does the message of Jesus speak to the existential anxiety that drives the ecological, multiplanetary, and artificial intelligence movements? Those are deep questions that we have to wrestle with. Because if we're preaching the gospel from the perspective of Martin Luther, a gospel that was really articulated for a people who lived in a hyper-religious society and who were dealing with anxieties that were fueled by that hyper-religion, if we're still articulating that gospel in the next 30 years to people who no longer inhabit a religious society and whose fears aren't religious, they're existential, then we're going to be speaking right over people's heads. So that's number two. And I'll circle back around to it for a moment in a little bit. Number three is truth versus reality. Now, postmodernism challenged the notion, is there such a thing as truth? And however, one of the things that you still had with postmodernism is what one philosopher, and I can't remember who it was, he termed it a shared perspective. And so, for example, you know, postmodernism might say there's no such thing as truth. And someone might come back and say, well, the White House is in Washington. Is that true? And the postmodernist will come back and say, that is a claim, but it's not truth claim in the way that postmodernism defines truth. What you're talking about is a shared perspective. A shared perspective is all of us across the globe know, and we share the perspective that the White House is in Washington. And because we have this shared perspective, then we know that is an accurate fact. But across the globe, we do not have the shared perspective that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. So you can't claim that that's an absolute truth. And so that's how they would argue that. And so essentially, a shared perspective is an agreed upon foundation of reality, right? Like there's an agreed upon sense in which, you know, there are certain things that we can say, these are anchored in reality. That's what a shared perspective offers us. But what I'm noticing is that there is actually a shift away from that as well. Maybe not in a radical sense of, hey, the White House isn't in Washington. You're not going to hear that. But there's a shift away from it toward a perspective that questions whether we exist in reality altogether. Is it possible that we exist in a simulation? Is it possible that the reality that we observe is not base reality? It's not true reality. It's not proper reality. And is it possible that our observance of the world actually creates the realities that we're seeing, and that those realities are not anchored in anything solid? And so that would come from notions like quantum mechanics. You know, the way you observe the world, you know, can actually determine what kind of particle emerges. I'm not going to get into all that. This isn't a science podcast, right? But there's some real challenges here. And so when you start to look at this notion of simulation theory and reality, and are we actually living in base reality, you begin to see some pretty wild ideas emerge. Now, is that the case for everyone? Like, you know, are kids walking down the street saying, we live in a simulation, guys, this isn't real? Of course not. It's probably one of those ideas that at the moment is most commonly articulated in Silicon Valley circles and really high techie geeky people. However, those ideas are definitely trickling down to younger generations, particularly through things like the metaverses of gaming. I'm thinking Roblox and Fortnite. And I know my kids, for example, they're both Generation Alpha, and they joke around about it a lot, but they do it a lot. You know, they, like, it comes up repeatedly, this notion that, you know, we live in a simulation and the world isn't real, and, you know, it's all a facade. And what actually constitutes base reality, right? And so this is actually a step beyond postmodernism. Postmodernism is just challenging the notion that, you know, there's no such thing as truth. But these shifts are challenging the notion that maybe there's no such thing as reality, or if there is a reality, we don't inhabit that reality. We inhabit something alternative, something synthetic, something fake. And a lot of it is also sort of fueled by concepts like the Matrix trilogy. I don't know if you've ever seen it, where humanity's all plugged into these machines that essentially create a artificial world that people live in, but it's not the real world. So anyways, I'm not going to go into that either. Watch the movies if you haven't watched them. It'll really, really help. But even if you step away from those more extreme notions of, you know, simulation theory and reality and base reality, you still are contending with a lot of things that are challenging reality, perhaps in simpler ways. For example, just this past weekend, Facebook unveiled some of their developments in artificial intelligence and how they've actually been able to create artificial intelligence avatars that you can befriend and talk to, and they don't sound like robots. And they inflect their voices, and they add nuance to their conversation. And it's a lot like talking to a person, but this is an artificial intelligence. And they're using celebrities like Snoop Dogg and Taylor Swift at the moment to create these personas that you can befriend on social media. And you can go on social media, you could talk to Snoop Dogg, you could talk to Taylor Swift. Now, it's not the real ones. It's an artificial intelligence version of them. But they respond and articulate themselves in very realistic ways. And so there's a concern that as this becomes more popular, that we will not only have physical friends in our social media, but we'll have artificial intelligence friends as well, which blurs the lines between physical reality and virtual reality. And these are lines that are already being blurred anyways, because if you think about it, modern young people, particularly Generation Z and Generation Alpha, they are digital natives, which means that for their entire existence, the digital world has been present. It's not like me, right? As a millennial, I was born in 1985, and, you know, I still remember for a big chunk of my life, we didn't have computers. There was no mobile phones. There was no iPad. There was really no internet. There was no social media. There was no YouTube, none of that. Whereas now, kids born now, this is the normal. And so really, if you think about it from a philosophical perspective, emerging generations are generations that inhabit two dimensions at once. they exist within the physical dimension, and they also exist within the virtual dimension. And so they have this dual dimensional existence, and the two aren't always congruent. Sometimes your virtual dimension, the person that you purport to be in the virtual dimension, isn't the person that you are in the physical dimension, and vice versa. So there's this dual dimensional reality or experience that's sort of stretching the boundaries of what's true, what's not true, what's real, what's not real. And even if you just look at the events that have defined the political spectrum over the last 5-6 years, you've got all this chatter about alternative facts and fake news and what can we really believe. And so there is a sense, there's a deep sense in which we're seeing not only truth being challenged now, but the very fabric of reality. What is real? What isn't real? Can we know what's real? Do we exist in what's real? There's so much of that going on. And again, I'm going to revisit that in a moment as well. I want to go back to point one and just offer a few thoughts as we go forward. And this is, point one was the whole deconstruction to reconstruction thing. And I want to sort of challenge us to think about this as missionaries. Don't think about it as a cultural critic. It's really easy to sort of look at the culture and say, oh my goodness, look at how deluded and dumb they are. You could do that if you want. Don't get me wrong. I'm not the boss of you, right? If you want to do that, you know, go nuts. But you're not going to be a good missionary if that's the attitude that you take. The attitude that we take as missionaries has to be more curious. It has to maintain a sense of protest and challenge to structures that are false and unhealthy. But it also has to have a sense of curiosity. So we're not like repelling people from the get-go. And here's the thing, the faith of Jesus has room for deconstruction, but it also aims toward reconstruction. So rather than attacking deconstruction, we need to encourage deconstruction and reconstruction. Now you might ask, how does the faith of Jesus have room for deconstruction? It's really simple. Just read the Gospels. Jesus was always deconstructing the assumed pictures of God that were prevalent in his society. And he would say things that were really bizarre, like, you heard that it was said, but I say to you. That's a deconstructionist lens. Or when the disciples said to him, call down fire from heaven to consume these people. You know, they're thinking of the story of Elijah, where Elijah calls down fire from heaven to consume these soldiers. And Jesus responds and says, you don't know what spirit you're speaking in. Now, if you take Jesus' response and compare it to the Old Testament story, it challenges us to deconstruct that story, because it's like, wait a minute, what do you mean they don't know what manner of spirit they're speaking in? Are you suggesting that Elijah was operating according to a spirit that wasn't Yahweh? And if so, what does that do to the story? But if not, what does that do with what you're saying right now? So there's just a lot of layers there. And of course, there's the way that Jesus interacted with women and with lepers and with tax collectors. All of it just deconstructing the social conventions, scaffolds, and assumptions that had become normative to his people in his generation. But he didn't just deconstruct and leave us in a pile of rubble. He pointed us toward reconstruction. If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. And so Jesus is the reconstruction of a true, enthusiastic, and healing picture of God. Now, here's the thing. If you're an Adventist, you shouldn't be complaining about deconstruction anyways, because we're like the OG deconstructionists in the West. Well, maybe not exactly. But Adventism has deep roots in deconstruction before postmodernism even came along, because Adventism has roots in the Radical Reformation, and the Radical Reformation has roots in the Protestant Reformation. And the Protestant Reformation is, guess what? A protest. That's why it's called Protestant. It's a protest of the structures and belief systems that have become calcified in the church. We're going to protest these structures and belief systems. We're going to deconstruct them, going back to scripture. Then the Radical Reformation takes that a step further. And then the Arminian and Wesleyan movements take that even further. And then Adventists come along and take it even further. We're a deconstructionist movement, but a deconstructionist movement with a vision for the second coming of Jesus. So it's not deconstruction for the sake of, let's just leave a pile of rubble. It's deconstruction for the sake of, let's recapture an accurate picture of God's heart and rebuild a true picture of his character so that we can prepare a generation for the second coming of Jesus. And so as the culture deconstructs and reconstructs, of course, they're going to do it in ways that we don't necessarily agree with, but we don't have to go to war with the culture. We can meet those anxieties where they are and say, hey, there is a way to do this that points to Jesus and the hope that he offers. And I think we really need to lean in on that. It's the same with these existential projects that are going on and the anxieties that fuel them. Like I said before, to me, it's really not that important if the metaverse is going to become a reality or not, if cyborgs are going to become a reality or not, if uploading consciousness to computer clouds is going to become a reality or not, if Elon Musk is really going to build a city on Mars or not. I don't really care if those specific things happen or not. Many of them might be fanciful and outlandish. But the point is that there are anxieties that are driving those projects. Those anxieties, primarily in the realm of the existential projects, are existential anxieties, anxieties of survival, anxieties of the human species going extinct. And so as believers, what do we have to say to that? What do we have to say to that anxiety? How does the hope that we have in Jesus, that in him the human species is forever secure, become a message that heals and soothes the fears that dominate so many people's lives today? My wife, who is a therapist, was telling me that one of the things that has emerged in the world of psychology and mental health is there is now, I believe it's a diagnosis. If it's not a diagnosis, it's at least a recognized condition that they call, there's a fear of the end of the world that is dominating emerging generations so much that even the mental health industries recognize and seeing this repeatedly enough to say, hey guys, this is a thing. People are afraid of the end of the world. And so what does that mean for us as Adventists? It means that our prophetic message needs to capture and emphasize its enthusiastic vision for a new society more. If we just keep preaching doom and gloom stuff, all we're doing is giving the culture what the culture already has. All we're doing is adding more fear to people who are already really afraid. Instead, we need to rearticulate our prophetic message to capture the enthusiasm of the world made new. And what about this last one of truth versus reality? I mean, there's definitely no way that we can agree with any of that stuff, right? And I would say, well, if you listen a little closer and look a little deeper, you'd be surprised. Scripture actually interacts with this because in the biblical vision, sin isn't just mere individual moral failure. Sin is a system that we're all plugged into, and it imprisons us within its false construct. And so from a biblical perspective, reality isn't really what we think it is. Reality isn't what we see. Reality isn't what we're familiar with. And that's a good thing, because in Jesus, we see reality for what it's really meant to be. This is why his kingdom is called the upside down kingdom, because his kingdom is base reality. Man's kingdom is not. We are under a spell. We're under an illusion. We're plugged into a matrix that Jesus wants to liberate us from. And there's this beautiful promise in the Old Testament that I think really speaks to this. In Isaiah 25, 7 to 8, it says this: on this mountain, God will destroy the veil that covers the nations. What is this veil that covers the nations? I think a modern way of thinking of it is kind of like the Matrix, right? Like there's this facade, there's this lie, there's this system that we're all plugged into that keeps us blind to reality. It says God is going to destroy this veil that covers all nations, the veil that stretches over all peoples. He's going to destroy this. And what is this veil? It goes on to say, he will destroy death forever. Now remember, sin and death are intertwined. The power of sin is in death. And so when we live under the power of death, we are under that system. We inhabit that virtual reality, if you want to use that as a metaphor. And God is saying, hey, I'm going to destroy that system. And the text goes on to say, the Lord God will wipe away every tear from their face. He will take away the shame of his people from the earth. The Lord has spoken. Which is to say that this veil, this system, this matrix that we inhabit is a matrix of death. It's a matrix of suffering because there's tears. And it's a matrix of shame that damages us and harms us individually and collectively as a species. And God is going to destroy all of this. He's going to wipe it all out. And he's going to bring his people back to base reality. reality the way he always intended it to be. And that's awesome. Like, we actually have something to say to the culture within the cosmologies that the culture is wrestling with that doesn't necessarily just boil back to the same old, you're wrong, we're right, listen to us. Now, again, these top three trends are broad and they reflect a more technological view of the world that we have in the West. I want to remind you to be mindful that depending on your local context, these three concerns may not be concerns at all. For example, in areas where social injustice and economic disparity are high, topics like metamodernism and existentialism and simulation theory might be the most irrelevant things. No one's even thinking about them, right? Crime, poverty, cost of living, those would probably be the bigger issues. In fact, right now, you know, you can't get away from the fact that cost of living is one of the big issues across the world. People are really struggling. Just look at what happened a couple of months ago when David Grush gave this, you know, historic congressional hearing under oath. He's saying the U.S. government has aliens. And how did the culture respond? No one cared. That's how it responded, right? Like, most people were just like, oh, okay, well, yeah, are they going to help me pay my rent? Because if not, I don't really care, man. And so the key to effective missionary living is to learn to listen and identify the anxieties that your target audience is most concerned with and either meet those anxieties or speak meaningfully into them. And with that said, you guys, if you love this episode and you want more, I want to invite you to join the Mission Collective. This is an Adventist postmodern evangelism school with over 30 videos covering topics like mission, theology, discipleship. We talk a lot about postmodernism. We talk a lot about metamodernism, and we get really practical. We're not just talking broadly and vaguely. We're getting really practical, looking at pop cultural manifestations and what this looks like in the life of your kids and in the life of your city. And we even look at post-humanism, which is all the stuff that's coming in the next 30 years, because the Mission Collective is aiming to be an Adventist training resource that equips secular missionaries for today, but also for tomorrow. I think it's time that we moved away from always being 20 to 30 years behind as a church and actually got 20 to 30 years ahead. So if that sounds interesting to you, head over to thestorychurchproject.com. And in the toolbar, if you just click the link that says training, you can learn more about the Mission Collective. All right, guys, that's it for today. Thank you for tuning in. I will catch you next week.